everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's September 2023, and you're listening to episode 357, which is a conversation about the work of the author Wendell Berry. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Stephen Mitchell. He lives in North Carolina and teaches English and Humanities at Covenant Day School. He holds a PhD in Humanities. Stephen has written an online Viewpoint feature article for the Christian Research Journal. Now, our Viewpoint articles address relevant issues in discernment, Christian ethics, and apologetics from a particular perspective, and that's not one that's usually shared by all Christians. So we hope that readers and listeners thinking on these viewpoint issues will be stimulated and enhanced, whether or not they end up agreeing with the author. Stephen's article is called How to Love a Neighbor in the Anthropocene, Christian Faithfulness via an Unsettling Agrarianism of Wendell Berry. You can read his article for free on our website, equip.org. And if you haven't already noted this, the Christian Research Journal has now morphed into an online magazine that is completely free for everyone. So please go to equip.org. Stephen, it's good to have you on the podcast again.
Thank you, Melanie. It's good to be here.
Today, we're talking about the work of the author Wendell Berry, and it's been quite some time since I've read Wendell Berry's work, but I do remember reading it more than a decade ago, and just it was just so different than something that I normally read. It's very, at least his fiction is more contemplative, and it's a slower pace is how I would describe it. And you know, as a listener, you might be wondering, well, why do we do literary apologetics episodes? And we do this because fiction tells stories in the same way that we cover movies and also TV series. And in this post-truth culture, stories seem to have a big impact on people, whether they be Christians or non-religious people, in terms of helping them think more deeply about a topic than somebody would normally think about because it's a story, and they consider things that maybe they wouldn't have if they just read a straight nonfiction type of analytical book. So stories are very important, and the gospel is a story as well. And so that's why we cover literary apologetics. And we do think it's important that you read some of these works. And so tell us a little bit about today, who Wendell Berry was and why is his work important?
Sure. And just one comment on what you were saying about literary apologetics. I think it's important to remember that truth is bigger than an argument. And so while argument is incredibly important to apologetics and to our faith, story is as well, because story gets at dimensions of truth, I think, that argument alone cannot do. So Wendell Berry is actually currently living. He's quite old. He's 90 years old now. He was born in 1934. He's a novelist, an essayist, a poet, arguably something of an activist as well. And his work, I think you're right. I think a contemplative is an important element that marks his work. But it is a contemplativeness that's rooted in a kind of gritty attention to the physical world, to literally to the earth and to the dirt. Berry has spent almost all of his life. There's short periods of time in his young adulthood where he traveled about, but has spent nearly all of his life as a farmer. And as an adult, as a writer in rural Kentucky. Having been born in 1934 and lived, you know, up to this point, Berry has a perspective on the modern world as a writer that I would say many of them don't, especially as having been born in a rural setting. He was born in a farming culture, one that was had its habits set prior to the rise of industrialized farming, or at least the intensification of industrialized farming post-World War II. And as such, he is he's aware of an incredible set of assumptions, values, he would argue vices, that sort of attach to the post-World War II industrialized, highly technophile way of life. And he's become quite a critic of that, from the perspective of a critic of that in terms of the damage it has done to rural land, the damage it has done to rural communities, and the loss of neighborhood and of I suppose the practices of care for the world that by his argument were more fully developed in the traditions of farming that predated the industrialization of farming, or food production, maybe is what we should say. Berry's work is rooted deeply in the Christian tradition. His arguments are often rooted in readings of Scripture. And his argument, and I think this is particularly important for, makes him particularly important for modern Christians, is that a lot of times his work is essentially saying, hey, the practices of the modern economy stand in opposition to the teachings of Scripture. I mean, this is what, and this I think is important for us who are pretty well just sort of part of the modern economy. Like we live in cities, we live modern lives. If we're going to also call ourselves Christians, then we've got to at least take account of this argument, because the implication is that a lot of our habits contradict the very text from which we say we, or on which we say we pattern our lives. If the truth of the faith is to be whole, if it matters to the faithfulness and the fruitfulness of our witness that our actions and the way we live match what we say we believe, match the sources that we say our beliefs come from, then his critique, it's serious enough and substantive enough for us to attend to if we're going to be consistent.
Well, speaking of that, I would like to ask you if there's anything in his work that's especially important for Christians and a Christian apologist. And I would say that one thing that struck me, again, it's been more than a decade since I read his work, is you talked about land and farming, and that's true. And while some of his characters are solitary, there's a sense in which his characters know community. And knowing who our neighbors are, and then if a stranger comes in, how do we respond to that? Because we know our neighbors and realize someone's a stranger. How do we interact with those people? And living our life like that is so antithetical, as you were talking about, to modern life, because a lot of folks, not everyone, but even if you live in a big city and you're not in, like, say, a subdivision in the suburbs, we pretty much, open our garage doors and, put our cars in after work and just do our own thing. Plus, if you live in a big city, that's easy to do. If you live in a high rise, you just, take the elevator and go to your individual unit. And we've become very isolated in the terms of just having that idea of community, which is very much essential to Christian theology, because the body of Christ is to pursue community. And so I would like to ask you a little bit about, just some of the themes in his work, or why in particular his work would be important to Christians. That's something that struck me. Again, it's been a while since I read his work, but just the idea, it's so different to have this agrarian outlook, but part of that in addition to his views about caring for the land, is this idea of not being isolated from other people in your area.
Yeah. So yeah, you know, for Barry, this idea of I think he would probably prefer the term neighborliness or neighborhood.
Yes, I think that's probably true.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's fine that we say community, but I think he would prefer those terms. You know, I remember as I was writing this particular article that it's going to go along with this podcast, that I was, and I've been reading Barry for many years, but I was reacquainting myself with his works that I had read and reading others that I hadn't. And I recognized, like, I don't even know the names of the neighbors who share the right-hand wall of my townhome, right? I live in a townhome, so I live very close to people. And this is a problem. Like, I'll just acknowledge that there's an act of neighborliness that I'm missing there. But so Barry's the central point here that Barry makes over and over again is that you cannot love people, you cannot care for people if you don't know them. Like, it's that simple. I think he says in, I think it's in What Are People For? It might be in his latest work, The Need for Wholeness. People who do not know each other do not trust each other. And people who do not trust each other do not help one another. For Barry, to be neighborly, to be in community, is to be actively participating in the life of another person in a way that provides both the opportunity and the responsibility to care for that person, not just about that person, not to just think, I feel, close to them. I feel, some sort of affection or friendship for them, but to care for them, to be at least in a position where when they are in need, right, you are somebody whom they can call upon. And when you are in need, they are somebody that you can call upon. And in order for that, and to him, this is an inexcisable element of the Christian ethic of neighbor love, that it requires, if you will, that not just that we live next to each other, but that our daily lives, and even in particularly our economic lives, in terms of aid, not competition only, that our economic lives intersect. And if we're not doing that, the implication of a lot of his work is, or if we don't have life set up like this, there's not really any meaningful way to practice actual neighbor love. And so that matters, that matters to us as Christians, because as Christ said, right, it is, you shall know them by their love. This shall all men know that ye are my disciples, if ye have love one for another. And Barry's work, Barry's thinking, Barry's argument is always that love requires practical action in the world. And so a modern, our modern lives, they just bend us, I think, more and more toward kind of siloing ourselves off, depending upon, depending upon money rather than depending upon one another. And there's obviously going to be a measure of tension here all the time. Barry isn't advocating, some sort of, that we don't take care of our own needs. In fact, he says an important part of neighborliness is that what you can do for yourself, you ought to do for yourself. But with that argument, he points out that given the nature of human beings and human life in this world, we ought not seek to live in a way where we are independent of our neighbors. And so I think, and I say this as one who lives, in a big city, in an urban enclave in a big city and has spent my, you know, my adult life in that. The very structure, the physical structure, as well as the economic structure of the world I live in, makes it very easy for me to simply neglect to even think about my neighbors. And that's troubling for me. I think that ought to trouble more of us. I don't mean from that we move immediately to the conclusion that Christians must, you know, sort of take up an agrarian lifestyle. But, you know, if we make all these arguments about, you know, what makes the Christian faith true and compelling, then we live in a way that makes it very easy and most likely that we're going to just go about our own business and not really serve our neighbors. Then there's a break, right, between what we profess and what we do, which undermines the truth of it, of what we profess. And so that, I think, the way he will trouble us as Christians, modern Christians in a, you know, in a, especially in an urban setting, the way he will trouble us is by pointing out how hard it is to be an authentic neighbor, you know, and how easy it is to just ignore real neighborliness, which is more than saying hi in the morning as you get into your car.
Please don't skip this short interlude because I am interacting with subscribers and finding that, in fact, all of them have missed the big announcement back in June that after 45 years in a print incarnation, the Christian Research Journal is now exclusively an online magazine that is completely free for everyone, absolutely no paywall. So that's really important because a lot of magazines have transitioned. They're still subscription-based. We aren't. We are not under a paywall. So you don't want to miss that because you want to go to equip.org and you want to look at all of the great free content. Now we're going to have new content almost every single week with very thoughtful interviews that are in-depth with our writers who are writing on various different subjects. So you won't want to miss out on what is coming up. And we have some really interesting topics that we're going to be talking about. One is about the Mormon mission message from the missionaries. I mean, they're still out in force. That's coming up really soon. We are also going to review the new book that was even featured in the New York Times called The Great Dechurching, about how people are leaving the Christian church. And as I mentioned in previous episodes, you won't want to miss out on some of our offerings for October, including going over the teaching of occultist Edgar Cayce, horror films, and we don't want to miss out on really looking in depth about the loneliness health crisis. How do we address that from a biblical viewpoint? So even more is coming up, and these are all very thoughtful, in-depth conversations with our authors that you won't want to miss. Now, while all of our articles are free for everyone without a paywall, we are still paying our authors. We are very much thinking that they are worth all the research they put in for us, and we really are grateful for their contributions, the Christian Research Journal. So you can partner with us and help us out in a really small way, and that would be giving us a tip. You can easily do that, maybe $5, $10, something like that, just giving up perhaps a coffee at your favorite coffee place for the week, or something like that, to give us a tip. And you can do that at our website, equip.org. Simply go to equip.org, see journal, click on that. You'll see Postmodern Realities, click on that. And literally every single one of our more than 350 episodes has a link in the description of that episode.
of where to go to give us a tip. So thank you for partnering with us. We really appreciate it. Of course, what you can do most of all is just simply tell friends about this podcast or share your favorite episodes on your social media accounts if you are on social media. So now back to our conversation about agrarianism and neighborliness through the work of Wendell Berry with Dr. Stephen Mitchell.
You just mentioned that he does want to trouble us as modern Christians. And so what's at the root of some of Wendell Berry's critique of modern culture? I mean, how does his critique of Christianity fit into his critique of modern culture that maybe should unsettle us a little or just give us some really good food for thought to chew on?
Yeah. Good question. I would say that the root of his critique of modern culture, and we might say the modern economy, in short, in the easiest way to say it, is that in his reading of it, it's driven primarily by violence and greed. That what can be done, right, through the ever-growing powers of technology, what can be done always or almost always wins out over what ought to be done. Whatever technology can do is sort of taken for granted to be progress. And the loss, the things that technology supplants, are simply not accounted for. One of his points is that as a new way of life comes in, let's say the industrialized way of life, the modern city, you know, the small town and the rural setting were supplanted. And, you know, and then the way to justify that was essentially that, well, more people are well off and wealthier as a result of this shift than were before. But Berry points out that the very definition of well off is the definition implied in that technological society. And there isn't an objective criteria by which to weigh, or it isn't used, whether the pre-industrialized way of life was actually better than, you know, the industrialized and post-industrialized way of life. And so, you know, people are unsettled from their lives. They are unsettled from their communities. They are unsettled from their jobs. Within that, you know, unsettledness, there's a lot of pain and there's a lot of suffering. There's a lot of distress. There's loss, as we've already said, of deep ties of neighborhood and deep ties of friendship and community as people have to leave the places that they might formerly have inhabited for generations. And the suffering and the damage that does is simply ignored. Further, his argument, and maybe we'll get into this a little later in the podcast, but that the application of industrial and technological methods and values and systems to farming, his argument has always been that it severely degrades the quality of the land that is farmed. And so it ruins something in the name of wealth. And Berry says this is just, it's unwise. He argues it's unsustainable. And he argues that it stands in opposition, and this is how the critique of Christianity fits into it. It stands in opposition to you know, the scriptural ethic that the earth is the Lord's, that we are keepers and stewards of it, and that we are not, in fact, free to just do with it whatever we please. That there is an ethical limitation that ought to inform our decisions, that has to do with conserving the health and the life of what is already there. Whether that be creatures, like, you know, non-human creatures, whether that be, you know, the fauna, the flora and the fauna, the plant life, whether that be the quality of the soil, the quality of the rivers, you know, or whether that be the human communities that, you know, exist there in those places. And so his critique of Christianity fits into that, or at least of modern Christianity, right, is that most of us just don't give that a thought. We kind of accept uncritically the notion that the increase in, if you will, the luxuries of life is self-evidently a net good and a net gain. And so what he's often asking Christians to do is to go back to the texts of their scriptures, right? And actually weigh the way they're living by those scriptures. I'm thinking, I remember this was years ago, and I don't know why this surprised me, except that I just hadn't seen it. I was very much younger, you know, very young man, just sort of introduced to Wendell Berry's work. But he points out in the book of Jonah, right, where you have this prophet called to take a message to the city of Nineveh, a city that was very brutal and unjust. And the message was, repent or I'm going to judge you. And of course, you know, Jonah doesn't want to do this. He tries to evade it. He ends up there. He gives the message and they repent. And he's very upset about it, right? The mercy of God toward the people of Nineveh is offensive to Jonah. But there's this fascinating little verse. It's the very end, actually, of the book of Jonah, where God says to Jonah, and there's various translations of it, but they all sort of revolve around this idea. And should I not pity Nineveh, that great city, in which are more than 120,000 persons who cannot discern between their right hand and their left? And I think most Christians would get that. Yep, that's the God we know, right? He offers mercy even to those who have done horrible things if they will repent. But there's a phrase that follows it, and Berry focuses on this, and the phrase that ends it is, you know, it says there's 120,000 persons who cannot discern their right hand from their left, and much livestock. Other versions say, and also much cattle. Others say, and also many animals. And so in the book of Jonah, right, there is this statement by God that says, essentially, I care about the lives of cows. And, you know, we can get, you know, we can get dismissive of this, and we can, you know, as so often happens, I think, when we hear conversations around, you know, conservation and environmentalism, it gets very, it can get very caustic. And often this sort of brusque and contemptuous dismissal of any, you know, any concern for creatures other than humans. But there's just one passage, right, in the scriptures that say that God wanted Jonah to go to Nineveh in part to avoid the destruction of cows. And so this says that our God cares about the lives and the quality of lives of those animals. And if we are living by patterns that just casually eradicate that, you know, then Berry would say, you know, we're not really being good Christians.
Now, one thing you've been talking about is that Wendell Berry feels a connection to the land. He is a strong proponent of agrarianism. And you also mentioned earlier on that he's known as an activist, I guess, an environmental activist, I would say. And he does definitely promote, you know, more sustainable agriculture. You mentioned in your introduction that he was in a time before what we know as modern farming. And I don't know if a lot of people know about modern farming. This is not a endorsement of anybody's particular position, but rather just a explanation that a lot of things that we see are just farmed by large, huge corporations. So smaller farmers who do things on a large scale, whether it be slaughtered cattle that we people, if they're, you're not vegan, that you eat, or, you know, consume chickens or eggs or anything like these, they're just done by these huge, large corporations. And so the kind of farming that we read about in specifically in his novels, although I've read some of his essays, is a different kind of farming. And I don't know, so many of us are removed from an agrarian life unless you have your own vegetable garden. I mean, I do have a friend at church. She grew up in a farm, and even though she's on the outskirts of our very large city of more than a million people, she, as just a side, you know, hobby, keeps 85 chickens and, you know, gives, you know, sells eggs to neighbors and so forth. But that's just not the norm. We're not close to land. We're not close to, and even if we have land, if you live in the suburbs, I mean, I don't want to make an assumption, but a lot of people have other people care for their lawn. You know, we don't have time. We have jobs. And so I just wanted to ask you about that a little bit more. Like, why does Barry consider this more sustainable, more not large corporations model of taking care of land, of farming land, to be, for him, more ethical, but also for him, more biblical?
Right. Good question. And yeah, and you're right. I mean, it's really odd. Of all the podcasts we have done together, I feel most uneasy about this one because I'm a townie. As I said, I live in a townhome. And for me to, you know, for me to talk about agrarianism is for me to talk about something I've encountered in books. I have been a gardener in the past when I've had the space to do that. But I certainly don't come at this as someone who, you know, is experienced in it. But yeah, so Barry, and if anyone, you know, that hears this is interested, Barry has laid out a real history of this in his work, starting with The Hidden Wound, moving then to his book, The Unsettling of America, which I think is an excellent introduction to this topic, and then his latest book, The Need to Be Whole, where he talks about the history of the shift from many small farms to a relative, in relationship, relatively few large farms. And, you know, part of this goes back to what I said earlier about neighborliness. When you shift from many small farms to a handful of massive farms, you necessarily reduce the community of people that live there. And so there is inevitably a breakup of the neighborhood that existed there before. There's a loss to the way of life, to the relationships, to the loves, if you will, that people had there. But second, he argues that, you know, and that's a big part of it. The machines, right? The big machines with which we, you know, modern agriculture is by which it's done, necessarily supplant people. Now, you know, then there's those that argue, well, that's a good because who wants to do farm work? Barry would argue, well, I want to. Barry actually does farm as well as write, and he farms. He spent his life doing most of his farming work with mules. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't use most of the modern equipment. And that he would argue that large, you know, industrial farming made it impossible for smaller farmers to stay economically afloat. And so they had to give up ways of life that they loved, and they had to leave communities that they loved. And this forced most of them, you know, into cities and into urban ways of life that they would not have chosen otherwise. Agrarianism, by his definition of this sort of small farming, which is not so industrialized. It's not so big. It's necessarily small because, you know, the amount that a family can meaningfully farm is necessarily limited. In his argument, allows for a richer and more diverse farming community. It allows more people to do it. And it leads, on average, he would say, to better care of the land. Now, you know, this is Barry's argument. It leads to better care of the land. I think it's pretty well documented that, you know, industrial farming really does degrade the soil, right? It's based upon primarily upon using herbicides and, you know, chemical fertilizers to get high yields, and, you know, and instead of, you know, sort of sustaining the quality of the soil, and over the years the soil degrades. It also leads to a lot of erosion. It leads to a lot of pollution of our rivers as the chemical runoff from the pesticides and the herbicides and such, you know, pollute our rivers and streams. He references what's called the dead spot in the Gulf of Mexico, where the Mississippi River runs there, because the consensus, as I understand it right now amongst scientists, is that pollution, not only from industrial farming, but largely from industrial farming, also from other industries, that runs ultimately into the Mississippi River and then out into the Gulf of Mexico, has created this enormous dead zone where, you know, sea life that formerly was there can no longer survive. So agrarianism, in Barry's estimation, is better because it's more likely that small holdings by many different people who are economically, you know, dependent upon the sort of multi-generational quality of that land is likely to be cared for better. The land is going to stay in good shape longer. And then the, you know, the sort of downriver, downstream consequences are not going to be so devastating. And this, he believes, is just is more ethical because, you know, it doesn't destroy, you know, it doesn't wreak havoc on or visit destruction upon, you know, as I just said, the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, or, you know, pollute, you know, it doesn't lead to as much pollution of rivers and streams. So I think about it this way. So you and I both live in the Charlotte area of North Carolina, and the main source of our water is from the Catawba River. I used to live, you know, just like half a mile from the river itself, and so would often walk along it. But there were signs posted all over saying, essentially, don't eat the fish from this river because the river has become too polluted and the fish has absorbed this and they are unhealthy for you. And some of that is from farming and some of that is from chemical factories. But Barry's point is, if we are deriving our the luxuries for our lives in a way that results in, you know, polluting our rivers such that the fish themselves cannot safely be eaten, that we're doing something that is on one hand stupid and on the other hand unethical. I think if you take it a step farther and you think about the poor, right? I can remember growing up as I did in Mississippi that one way that the poor, and that included us, often supplemented our diet was quite literally by fishing. And so if those fish aren't available for people to eat safely, then we are also, you know, we are also doing an injustice to those who would try to live from that natural source of food. And we're doing an injustice to those creatures who have, I don't know that the word right is the correct word here, but whose being alive is, we say as Christians, finds its source in God, And so who's in, you know, if we might say bodily integrity matters, right? And so if we're living this way, then we are not really making the earth fruitful. We're not caring for the earth as if it is a, as if it is God's, right? Which is what our scriptures actually say. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, and we stewards of it. We are instead acting toward the earth as if it is, you know, simply a resource to fill our desires and wants, whatever they be. And that is ultimately unsustainable because, Barry would argue, and I think I'm convinced by this, we live ultimately from the earth. However deep and profoundly abundant its resources are, they aren't infinite if we don't live in a way that they are renewed. And so we are not, the industrialized farming, Barry sees as just another example of the larger unconcern for the downstream, both literally and, you know, metaphorically through time, impact of what we do so that we can have what by contemporary standards is a comfortable life, these you know, very luxurious lives, frankly, in comparison with most of history that most of us live. And that is why agrarianism, in his mind, is a limit to that, right? Because it goes by a different standard. It accepts what he calls, and he's gotten this from a man named Aldo Leopold, he calls it the land ethic. And decisions of what we're going to do or not do are rooted in whether or not it is healthy for the land and for everything that lives from the land. Because ultimately, that is what sustains us, right? And he also makes a number of arguments that I probably don't have any time to elaborate, but that essentially he links exploitation of land with exploitation of people all the time. In fact, he argues that the very dark history of slavery in our own country is rooted in part in the same sort of desire to yield a luxurious life without having to work for it. And that same desire, though we finally outlawed slavery, he said that same desire really feeds the movement toward, you know, massive corporate farming. And just as it was destructive of the lives of human beings, just as slavery was destructive of the lives of human beings, and often of the land itself, so modern industrial agriculture is, in Barry's understanding of it and presentation of it. So I've gone on about that one, I think, at sufficient length.
Well, I do want to tell our listeners, I mean, we are exploring the work and the worldview of one particular author. That doesn't, we just want to put it out there. It doesn't mean that, at least for myself, that I hold to his view or agree with everything about his view, but I do find it fascinating, or that his view would maybe change behaviors, although I think that's what he would want. I mean, you can extrapolate some of his things. For example, you were just talking about slavery, but in our modern times, I mean, these are not undisputed facts, you know, that a lot of clothing made by fast fashion, which would be really inexpensive popular brands that people just cycle through because we don't want to pay, and I don't want to pay, if I want to be honest, $350 for a pair of jeans. I can't afford that. But that would be what it would take to make it in America versus, you know, going to fill in your blank fast fashion where you can get a pair of jeans on sale for, you know, $12.99 or something. I mean, that's a big difference for getting a pair of, you know, with tax, $15 versus $300. So, you know, these are things that, you know, they're made in other countries. If you look at your labels, they're made in Bangladesh and all other kinds of places, not just there. So, and I do have those labels and inexpensive jeans in my closet. So I do appreciate me thinking, I don't want to be hypocritical. We also have a, it's kind of adjacent to this, you know, article that we've published before. And like, you know, should you boycott things that you don't agree with? Those are different issues. But it's kind of the same thing. You know, would you stop shopping at fast fashion because you realize this is made in Bangladesh and they don't have OSHA or whatever? But these are some of the things that Wendell Berry does make us think about. And actually, when you look at the, I'm not really somebody, I'm a total city person. I love freeways, I love concrete in the city. But recently, my GPS took me, I was going to a different part of the state, Eastern North Carolina, and it took me, I don't know what happened. I must have pressed the wrong button, but it took me off the regular freeway and the back roads. And by that time, I was committed. So I didn't realize that there were all these, not too far away from where I live in the city, about an hour out, cotton fields. And it made me think as I looked at just field after field after field, I just was like, wow, I use cotton every day, either in clothing or cotton balls for my face or whatnot. And I just had never thought of like, well, what before machines, what would it take to get all these tiny cotton balls full of burrs and things out? And it really made me think. So I don't think suburbanites necessarily are confronted with land and some of these issues. So that, you know, I still want to explore this. So what other traditional sources would Berry appeal to as he's, you know, thinking about this agrarian ethic? And, you know, why would these sources be important? I think it's helpful for us to like think these things through whatever our worldview is, because when we sit down and eat some food, we didn't farm it. Like, how did it get there? You know,
how did it get there? Yeah. I mean, I'm with you on this, Melanie. I find him troubling, and but I certainly don't, you know, find a way to say that to start dictating out of this particular behaviors that people must take. So I would say to answer specifically the question about traditional sources, and this makes Berry interesting, really interesting to me, is that he roots his critique, of course, in scripture, but he roots it also in Homer, in the Odyssey and the Iliad. He roots his thinking in Dante, in Virgil, in Shakespeare. These aren't obviously the only writers he appeals to. He's, you know, a deeply and widely read man. But I think this is interesting because part of what Berry is trying to do is to say, hey, the Western tradition is not just a tradition of exploitation. It is not just a tradition of sort of uncritical embrace of, you know, economic luxury and technological innovation. And that, you know, you can find in these sort of these deep sources of the Western tradition, you can find ground upon which to intellectual ground, spiritual ground, ethical ground on which to make these criticisms. So he does so not by abandoning Western tradition. Again, not that Western tradition is not, you know, a flawless pool of wisdom. It's a human tradition with, you know, all sorts of conflicting and contradicting visions in it. But there is this cautionary, stewardly, careful, thoughtful, contemplative element in the Western tradition that asks not just what is easiest, right? What will get us the most for the least effort, but what is good in the most holistic sense, for everyone concerned in this economic relationship, both the laborer and the owner and the buyer and so on. And so, you know, appealing to those traditional sources, I think, I just think it helps to open his voice to more people. And also, you know, given the unfortunate nature of our modern politics, allows for this question of how we live, the actual, you know, ethical nature of our economic lives and the ethical quality of what we're doing with the natural world. I think it allows it to transcend, you know, unfortunately, this is so often a left-right split, you know, a conservative-liberal split, all of this. I think Barry manages to do this, you know, to mount this criticism without aligning himself entirely with one side or the other. And if you read him carefully, he will be as, you know, as critical of sort of popular right policies as he is critical of popular left policies. Because, you know, as he tries to show that too often both of them simply appeal to just a different form of consumerism. And so that's, I think, why the traditional sources matter. I think they give credence to the deeply considered nature of his work. Like, he's not working only from his own mind, right? But from the influence of these, you know, these profound thinkers over millennia. So that's all I'll say about his rootedness in the Western tradition.
I want to go back to something we mentioned at the top of the podcast about neighborliness and community. I agree with you that neighborly is probably a better way to put it, only in that some of his characters in his fiction, his short stories, tend to be more solitary but neighborly people. And neighborly not just to people in their own context, in terms of literal neighbors. We talked about, do we know our neighbors in a suburban context, but also just neighborly to the stranger. And so how is Barry's, you know, his agrarian critique, we've talked about that, and, you know, modern society relate to really a biblical and Christian ethic of what it means to love our neighbors?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, in short, Barry argues that neighbor love is primarily, I think about his work as a whole, neighbor love is primarily attention to, quite literally, your neighbors, the people who are, you know, near enough to you for you to lend meaningful aid, to live in a meaningful relationship with. Barry believes that neighbor love requires work, like quite literally a kind of willingness to provide, and I think I mentioned this earlier in the podcast already, economic aid. So here would be an example. He often, in numerous of his, you know, numerous essays and such, even some of his fiction, he will bring in the Old Order Amish as emblems of, or as examples of people who enact this ethic quite robustly, in that they live in these tight communities. They, of course, eschew a lot of the technological innovations that most of us just embrace and accept, but they aid one another deeply in their economic lives, and they live in a regular community with each other. They accept the physical demands of that life. They seem to willingly accept that. And they limit necessarily their indulgence in, you know, the consumer economy. Now, the question I think that, I, you know, there's a danger here, because the realities of history are that agrarian economies can be quite closed to strangers. You know, they can be quite insular. They can be suspicious of outsiders. All of that stuff is quite possible. But I think that this, you know, if there is developed in a community this sense that the other is my neighbor and that I am responsible to care for him, then that ethic, it's not at least unthinkable that if a stranger is to show himself or herself in this place, you know, he or she would receive, you know, a measure of welcome, and be allowed to make a home there. And I think this is different from sort of our modern notion in the urban settings of laissez-faire, which is, yeah, come do your own thing. Everybody's welcome. But we're welcome in a way that means we're not really going to bother each other or bother with each other, right? We're just going to sort of let everybody kind of be what they are and on their own. To go back to my own sort of unease with this, I don't know the names of the people that share the right-hand wall of my townhome. And so the need in an agrarian setting, as Berry imagines it, or as Berrien says it was prior to industrialized farming, the literal need of one another in order to carry out the planting and the harvesting that sustained life, you quite literally needed your neighbor's help. That structure lent itself to an ethic of neighbor love that was, of course, never perfect, right? He's not a dreamy romantic, but it lent itself to an ethic of neighbor love that he suggests our modern cities cannot offer. As far as now, you know, part of what can be a limitation here, I think, is that the care doesn't, you know, I think about, you know, the Christian sort of evangelistic ethic, right? Which Christ says, go you into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature, beginning in Jerusalem, going from there to Judea and all Samaria and unto the ends of the earth. And I don't want to make too easy a jump from agrarianism to, you know, to sort of, you know, an evangelical work, but he's really concerned with the local space, right, that you're already in. He doesn't say much about, you know, reaching out beyond that. But part of that is because Berry says that love always requires careful attention to particular people in particular places, particular creatures. And so I think what he would argue is that, you know, the only way really to practice neighbor love is in close conjunction with those around you. Like in you can only practice neighbor love to those who are near you. And if that neighbor love is going to spread, it can only spread by sort of that ethic spreading to different places. But the practice of that ethic is always going to be sort of narrowly focused. And so agrarianism is for him a place where that, it's an economic model that requires neighbor love to work, and so encourages it. The modern city instead sort of bends us toward dependence upon, you know, more and more labor-saving technologies and income, right? It would be, we don't share labor, you know, much in a modern city, whereas labor sharing in the agrarian economies, at least of Kentucky as he described it, was just part of the, it was just part of the community ethic. You helped one each other on, you know, on one another's farms. And in so doing, you are, Barry would argue, you are loving your neighbor as yourself. And so if we're going to be people of neighborly love, we have to have economic practices. I think he would, I know he would, he says it. We have to have economic practices that encourage it and allow it. And that's why he goes back to the old order Amish. He would say that they are, whatever their limitations, they are at least with each other still engaged in a way of life that demands, if they're going even to survive, right, that they love each other through action.
Yes, I was thinking of a specific story which kind of expands on what you were talking about, the Christian ethic of loving others, our neighbors. I mean, anybody is our neighbor besides ourselves, right? And so the one I was thinking of, and I can't remember the actual, he's written more than 50 short stories, but it was cold or something like that. And again, it was a farm in Kentucky and a farmer who didn't say anything really, except for there was either a boy or a father and a boy passing through his land, and it started snowing or something, and the boy needed a coat, or dad needed a coat, and he went and got them a coat, the farmer. And he didn't say anything, but he showed them mercy and compassion. And I think that for some of us, we're like, well, we don't live on a farm, on a rural farm. But I think that could still, for the modern person living in the city, say something. Do we know something enough about our surroundings, like you were saying, you know, not knowing your actual neighbors you share a wall with, that do we know enough that if somebody had a need, even if we didn't know them well, we'd be able to meet that need?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And very often I don't. Like, I just don't. And, you know, that means I need to be asking myself, like, how do I need to change my practices so that I am neighborly to the people that I'm actually geographically a neighbor of, right? I think about, and I know you see this here in Charlotte, like just the numbers of people who stand at intersections in our city.
Oh yeah. There's some right by where I live. Like it's the same, I want to say it's like a couple that are panhandling, but it's the same folks that sit there. And you know, what's interesting, we're kind of getting far from farming, but a friend of mine, she was like Mrs. North Carolina or something like that for a year. And she, that was like her thing where she wanted to help people who were homeless and needed shelter and those kinds of things. But she's the actual kind of person, even though she does live in a very, you know, suburban neighborhood type of place. And I don't think I'd do that. She got to know all these people because she would stop her car, have stuff, talk to them, get to know their names. And I think she decided, oh, I'm going to make that kind of my particular community outreach. But then through that, she actually practiced it. And I think to my day, still, I think to myself, oh, that's so bold. I don't think I would try to roll down my window and get to know these people. And she actually did. And she would pray with them and talk to them, and even just at the stoplight. So there's a way in which we can go out of our comfort zone. I mean, that's a little radical for me, but.
Well, I think that this is a moment that connects what we've been trying to say back to at least what Barry says agrarianism offers. And that is, like you said, wow, that's bold. And you and I both know that most of these are at traffic lights.
Yes,
and,
exactly.
And we're in cars. And in other words, the structure of our city is meant to move us through those spaces very quickly. And it requires something extraordinary. Your words were bold of us to stop and make anything out of that moment. I mean, we would interrupt the flow of traffic, right? We would, you know, you can throw some coins at them or give them a bottle of water if you have it with you, but it isn't, whereas I think back to the short story, very short story you're referencing, whereas, you know, in the agrarian, rural, small town and farm economy that he's describing in much of his fiction work, this capacity to care for people it doesn't require something extraordinary. It's actually more natural, a more sort of organic act. And that is both, I think, what is really compelling about Barry's critique is his ability to see that the modern city doesn't offer that. But then also, like, that's where, when I get done with his work, I think, okay, I don't have the capacity to become a farmer. I can't relocate and, you know, and become an agrarian. Even those communities, as he records, have been heavily degraded. So what is a city dweller to do? And I don't think that, despite the challenge, you know, he gives to the technologically oriented lifestyles of modern urbanites and suburbanites, I don't think it's easy to move from his work to sort of a practical response to the structure of our lives in modern cities. Like, how we have to ask the question, but I don't think agrarianism offers a clear pattern for how to be a neighbor in an urban setting. That's something we've got to take up on our own.
Right. I think there's limitations to his view because, you know, not just economically, in terms of if you live in a city, I mean, well, okay, I could go to the farmer's market. That is one thing I could do. I could go to, in my neighborhood, they started doing like a farmer's market co-op. And again, it's kind of like one of those things, well, they will deliver stuff to your door, but it's one of those things where it's, you know, what's the trade-off? Yes, I'm supporting local farmers, but also it can't be for the person who doesn't have certain means because it's extremely expensive that you pay for in advance. Like, you get all this produce, plus I can't choose it, plus it's $500 up front, you know, for a month or something like that, which... Yeah, the Share Art Co-op, they started that in my neighborhood, and we have that in California, which is great, but not everybody has the budget, and or I don't have a large family, so if someone, you know, gave me $50 worth of produce, I couldn't eat that in a week, you know what I mean? So, you know, there are some limitations to his view, and especially when we're considering the economics of a city. I mean, again, we can pay for certain things that are more expensive, grass-fed beef and this and that, but we are limited by certain items unless we got into a local's farmer market. To me, though, that still has that sheen of, I don't know how else to say, like, for the bougie wealthy people that feel good about themselves. And I'm not saying I'm in that camp, but, you know, I can go and buy homemade bread. And I have friends at church that go to farmers markets and sell. They have a large family and their girls bake and they're homeschoolers and they sell their bread. But, you know, if I want to support their bread, it's $10 a loaf. So, I mean, is that in my budget to pay $10 for one loaf of bread? But they made it and I know it's like from organic flour or whatever. So, you know, we're getting a little far flung from apologetics, except for to say that apologetics also includes ethical issues. And how do we relate ourselves to the care of things? And I think how modern suburbanites relate themselves to the care of things, let's say animals, would be, you know, if people are pet owners, like, how do you treat an animal? How do you treat those? If you don't have a pet, how do you treat other animals around you? People have pets and those kinds of things. And I do think the Bible speaks to those. But, you know, I want to hear from you. There are certain limitations, you know, I wish I could be totally like, hey, I could buy all of my jeans at, you know, $500 a pop or whatever, but that's just not practical for my clothing budget. And we also have to be stewards of our money. So how does you know, his particular worldview, and he literally lives in a rural area, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, good question. I don't think we're taking very seriously if he's just food for thought. Like, and I think you alluded to that already earlier in the podcast, like the implication of his work is that we need to make changes in how we live if his arguments hold, right? Like if you find yourself in agreement with his arguments, then you need to make changes in how you live. He even acknowledges, though, even in a rural setting, that he's not even able to live entirely by his own ethic, right? So he recognizes that we are often caught in social and economic patterns, you know, and are sort of at the, you know, the disposal of certain economic forces that we just don't have the capacity to overcome, right, entirely. I think probably I'll just speak to maybe the limitations of his work as it regards the economies of cities more than the rural, since he knows way more about that than I do. I think what I do often see in Barry is this kind of there, and I think this is probably just because, as you pointed out, he has spent his life in a rural setting thinking about rural life, and he hasn't spent his life in a city thinking about city life. But I don't think that his, you know, he doesn't seem to see much space for virtuous life in cities. And I think that there are people, I can think of people I know here in Charlotte, for example, Steph and Wes Vanderlucht, who are started Kinship Plot, who are trying very hard to find ways to create like intentional community neighborhoods where people live together, where they even live somewhat from the land, in that they, you know, they garden so that, and in places where the poor can be involved in this, like where poor people can have access to garden plots so that they can perhaps have fresh produce that they might not otherwise be able to buy. You know, and I think about scriptures, we can just go back to what I said at the very beginning, to Nineveh, right? The regard that the divine the scriptural tradition has for cities, right? For large spaces where large groups of human people live together. And our scriptural tradition does have a place and a place of affection for and a vision for cities that are fruitful and functioning and where justice and, you know, and health do reign. I think our cities are far, far, far from that. And I think Barry's work really highlights how far they are from that. But I think that the problems of urban alienation are not going to be solved solely by renewing the rural parts of our world, right? It may be that we can't really solve our city problems without solving, you know, our rural problems. I think I would very much believe that, but I think that our cities are going to present their own particular challenges. And I just don't think Barry just doesn't take that up. And so for those of us who are urbanites, who live in big cities, which is more and more of us, right? We're going to have to ask how we do that here. And it's not going to be the same as how you would do it in rural Kentucky. And so that's, I think, you know, where the limitation of his work for urbanites comes in.
And I do want to tell our listeners, I mean, our president of the Christian Research Institute, Hank Hanegraaff, has talked about in the last several years a lot about the Book of Nature. And I do think as modern folks, we tend to think certain parts of the Bible don't apply to us because we're not in an agrarian situation. But the world itself, I think all Christians, no matter your tradition, agrees that the Bible and the New Testament teaches that when there is the resurrection of the body, there will be renewal of the actual
of the earth, absolutely
physical earth,
absolutely.
And so, I, you know, no matter what your eschatological view is, okay, what can we all agree on? Well, Jesus is going to return, and not just the people, humans, will have physical bodies resurrected, but the earth itself will be. And so I do think that there's a sense of, we're not trying to create a utopia here, but there is a sense of stewardship, right?
Absolutely. And that the gospel promise, as you just pointed out, is for a renewal of the whole creation, right?
Yes.
That the passing away, the imagery of the passing away of the heavens and the earth is not because they're worthless. It's the passing away of the order under which they are burdened, so that they can be renewed, right? So that the new life, as you said, the resurrection can come forth. And so, yeah, the gospel, if you will, is for the creatures too. Not in the same way, obviously, that it is for us, right? But it is for the creatures too. And that means that our God cares about this a lot.
And, you know, we're in a state that is small enough that you can get to the rural parts and the big cities within a few hours. And so, like, people, you know, I'm not saying people need to do anything, but if they're thinking, well, how do I connect the dots with any of this? I've heard of people that they're like, are some family farms, you know, out and about, and you can go, and instead of just buying your beef from, you know, the major company, you can go, if you have a big freezer, which I don't, you can go over to some place and pick out your lamb or whatever, and then buy part of a cow or something like that, and they'll pack it up for you. And then the cow itself had a much better life than in some big industrialized complex, even though, you know, you're going to be eating it and so forth. So there are people doing things like that. And I mentioned already the farmers co-ops. And actually, if you did, like, I know some people who have like 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 kids, for them, you know, spending $500 on produce a month is probably what they would do if they went to the local grocery store. Well, they can help the local farmer out. Plus, they're probably pretty busy and it can be delivered to them. So, you know, I don't have that huge, gigantic family where I probably couldn't use it on. Plus, my kids had a whole bunch of food allergies, so we couldn't use, they're allergic to a lot of vegetables, so we couldn't use all the vegetables. But there are things you can do. I just want to end before I ask you your fun question, is that the school where Stephen teaches, I know of a dad there, and there's a community garden right just down the street, and he doesn't live in a neighborhood where he can gardens, and he gardens there. And recently he said, I guess, about a year ago, he said, hey, I have extra lettuce, you're welcome to some. And I went there, and it would be good for some time for somebody to see actual, like, what does lettuce look like when it's not in a grocery store? This lettuce was so large that when I got home, I took a picture of it. It was the size of the width of my double fridge, you know, not a side by side, but yeah, I have fridge and freezer that open up kind of together, not a top and bottom. And it was that large. It was beautiful and it was gorgeous. And he is farming in the city. So it can be done. He's just doing it in a community garden. And basically, I don't think they get produce from their grocery store, because they just cycle it through. They have tomatoes and whatever else they have. So it's not impossible, but just to think through creatively, maybe you can't do that, you know, just one family, you're too busy, but maybe a bunch of families could tend to a community garden and keep it. And again, I'm not saying people should do this, but it is helpful to think of actual nature, because it's part of what God created. And it doesn't need to mean, and again, I don't think we're saying this is a political issue. There's people on both sides of the aisle. We're just saying, what does the Bible say that's biblical and spiritual truth about the world that God created?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well, on a much lighter note, we know from the introduction, Stephen is a teacher. So, Stephen, what is one of your favorite things about going back to school and the rhythms of the school year?
Oh, good question. I think I just really look forward to the conversations that I have with my students over the books that we study. That's probably my very favorite thing that I don't have during the summer and love during the school year.
Well, thanks, Stephen, for being on the podcast again and for this thought-provoking discussion.
All right. Thank you, Melanie. It was a pleasure to speak with you.
You've been listening to episode 357 of the Postmodern Realities podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Dr. Stephen Mitchell. He has written an online Viewpoint feature article about the work of Wendell Berry, and it is called How to Love a Neighbor in the Anthropocene, Christian Faithfulness via the Unsettling Agrarianism of Wendell Berry. And you can read it for free at our website, equip.org. Stay connected with the Christian Research Institute and all the new content we have coming your way. The best way to do that is to head on over to our website, equip.org. There you will find thousands of free resources right at your fingertips, from articles to video to audio, and it's all for free. You'll find our podcasts hosted there, as well as the Bible Answer Man broadcast, which is hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and streams live every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. In addition, you don't want to miss out on subscribing to Hank Unplugged, which is the podcast of Hank Hanegraaff. And in that podcast, he has really in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people. And in addition, he has a new series on his podcast feed called Hank Unplugged Shorts, which Hank goes into the headlines in the mainstream media and refutes a lot of those cultural issues that we have in these short podcast episodes. And there's quite a few of them. You don't want to miss out on them. Now, if you want to find some of this at other places where it's all in one place, really subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's a great way to get all of our content there, our podcasts there, and different individual questions theologically that people have that Hank answers at our YouTube channel. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, I don't know how to subscribe to YouTube. I don't have a YouTube account. Well, actually, you might just have a YouTube account. If you have a Gmail address, you have a YouTube account. Just log into YouTube with your Gmail address and search for Bible Answer Man channel, and please become one of our subscribers. In addition, if you see that bell icon right there on our front page, please click that, and every time that we have new content, you will receive a notification that new content is up on our channel for you to be able to consume. So thank you so much for the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute. We are grateful for you listening and reading and watching.